Welcome into another edition of the Dana and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. Dan is on the line, as is the legend Brian Snow, who is kind enough to make an appearance this year on the actual scheduled night of the preseason podcast. So we're coming at you before the first game of the year this time. So that's exciting.
Sometimes there's beer to be drank, Rick.
You know, I mean, what are you going to do? Well, we'll start off the podcast by doing basically what we did last season at this time of the year, which is we've seen this team now for at least an exhibition game. Snow, you've seen some practices as well. Guys, give me your positive takeaway and your negative takeaway that you've seen from this team so far after one exhibition and maybe some practices.
For me, the positive, just how big and athletic and versatile they are. I think you're seeing, especially when Tyreek Jones is out there, you're seeing a team that's going to be able to switch one through five. They're big. They're just athletic all over. They're going to rebound. They can do a lot of different things in a lot of different ways. I think that's the biggest strength of this team. On top of that, they're old. It's an old team. You're starting, two seniors, three juniors or something like that. A lot of experience. Guys that have played together for a long time. So those would be two major pluses. The biggest minus is this team still can't shoot. And anyone who thought they could shoot is greatly, I don't know what I'm looking for. But
mistaken?
Yes. Mistaken is a good word. But, I mean, they're the same guys who couldn't shoot last year. Now, they might be a little bit better this year, but they're not going to be good. So that's just the reality.
Well, Dan, you won't have to dig deep into your thesaurus to beat Snow on this take. give me your positive and negative takeaway.
Well, actually, my positive, the initial one, the initial one that I came up with is the exact same one Brian said. This is one of those teams that gets off the airplane and you're like, oh, it looks like an NFL DB room. But I guess if you want me to go beyond that, what I would say is that in the exhibition game, the two freshman newcomers that got the majority of the minutes for the newcomers, Demir Bishop and Zach Fremantle, look like dudes who belong here, who are capable of playing at this level, who have picked up a lot of the system already, who are not afraid to attack, who are not afraid to get in the mix. And obviously for a team that struggled a lot with depth last season, that's a welcome injection of talent. I would also say that that Bryce Moore was very impressive in parts of his performance against UIndy on, what was that? Was that, I guess it was last weekend. I thought he was really impressive, especially defensively, although playing against overmatched players who had just played the night before, it probably was a little bit easy for a guy like that. But I thought he was pretty impressive in his more so on defense, but he showed some signs on offense as well. And obviously we haven't seen Kiki Tandy or Jason Carter yet, both of whom figure to be impact guys. So I think the depth issues from last year should be alleviated. And a lot of the problems that Travis had last year, maybe with the end of games, because a guy's getting tired in a short rotation, that may not be a problem this year. In terms of a negative, I mean, obviously the shooting is a thing. And I think that the problem with that is that you've seen a Division II school, albeit a pretty good Division II team, put out the blueprint of how you can defend this team pretty successfully, which is sort of have everybody plant a foot in the paint and force Paul Scruggs, Najee Marshall, Quentin Gooden to try and crab dribble between four dudes. And so I think that Xavier is going to have to find ways to manufacture offense to get cheap baskets off of runouts, off of steals, et cetera, because they're just not going to be able to, in my view, to score consistently in the half court unless they figure out a way to start hitting threes, or at least enough threes to keep defenses honest. And so far they have not done that.
Yeah, I'll just piggyback on you there, Dan, because I think the negative is obvious. It's what both of you mentioned. And to me, it's not just that they can't shoot, because we knew that was going to happen, but it's the fact that they've been so careless with the ball in both the exhibition and the scrimmage. And granted, I mean, there are certain guys that aren't playing that are going to be a huge part of what you're doing. And I understand some of the upperclassmen may not take a close scrimmage as seriously as they're going to take a real game and all of that stuff. But there's just been too many instances already where they look a lot like they did early last year, where teams pack the defense in, they have nowhere to go, they end up giving the ball to Quentin Gooden late in the shot clock and asking him to do something with it. That can't happen as often as it did last year. The bright side, I would say, that we saw in the exhibition is, in the second half, I thought Quentin Gooden did exactly what they need him to do to sort of break that when they get into a rut and can't get out of it offensively. He was a playmaker, and he was driving, beating his man off the dribble with the intention of making a play for his teammates and finding people. And occasionally that led to him making a really impressive finish. He did that twice in the game. So I thought he had a great second half in the exhibition, and that was a positive takeaway because Xavier needs him to be a lot better this year than he was last year. But the concerns on offense are still certainly there.
I'm curious for you guys, because I know you've seen practice a lot this summer and seen a little bit more what Travis has been doing with the team. Another big issue last year is that, as we talked about a lot, halfway, two-thirds of the way through the season, this team was, at least from a statistical standpoint, a downright bad defensive team. At one point, falling below 200 in defensive efficiency. Obviously, they made a really nice rebound over the last 10 games and ended up, I think, in the top 20 in that particular period of time in the country. I thought the defensive communication and system looked a lot tighter so far from what I've seen. Do you guys kind of get the same sense? Do you anticipate that we're not going to see the same kind of lapses and sort of freelancing that we saw at the beginning of last year?
Yeah, I think so. More so than anything, I think those guys all learned they're just not good enough to not play defense. Because let's be honest, they watched Trayvon Blewett not play defense for 2 years. And J.P. McCura not play defense the way he was supposed to play defense. With Trayvon, he just didn't give effort. With J.P., he gave too much effort. And I'm not sure which one's worse in a pack line system. So, that kind of rubs off. Downhill, those guys saw that. They said, hey, we're the best players on the team now. We can do that. Well, the problem was they can't score 2,500 points or whatever Trayvon scored and 1,500 or whatever JP scored and bail themselves out of it. So I think they realize now. I think they're embarrassed that they didn't make the NCAA tournament, to be perfectly honest with you. And from what I've seen, they've been pretty locked in on defense and practice, and the numbers would indicate that as well. When you're talking about the scrimmage and the exhibition game, also Bryce Moore is a really, really good defender, and he's actually a fairly smart defender. Whereas Kyle Castlin was a debacle for the first half of the last season playing defense, just didn't know where he was supposed to be. It was just a disaster. So I think that's a big change as well.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's just a different intensity on that end of the court, both in practice and what we've seen in the exhibition already. I think the older guys definitely have set a different tone than they did last season, and Bryce Moore has been a big part of that as well, because he's really intense on the defensive end and kind of a tone setter. So I think he's really helped. One of the other things that I know is kind of a big topic right now and is going to be a topic into this first week of the season is the injuries. Jason Carter's been out, Tyreek Jones has been out, Kiki Tandy's been out, Daniel Ramsey has been out a ton. Brian, let's kind of go through those guys one by one and give an update of whether you expect them to play this week or not. Tyreek Jones is obviously back. He already played in the exhibition. He's going to be fine. What about Jason Carter? What's the latest on Jason Carter that you've been hearing?
I think he'll play, but he'll be on a pitch count. I think in their ideal world, 15 minutes, three, four-minute wars, whatever it may be, maybe up to 20 minutes. But I think the plan is for him to play, but he's going to be now minute restrictions have a way of going away if you need to win, but on a minutes restriction.
Yeah, he's been out almost a month. He had a back issue and he returned this past week, but he was limited in practice. Kiki Tandy just went out this past week with a foot injury, about a week and a half now, 2 weeks almost, and he's been in a boot this past week. What do you think about Kiki Tandy, Brian?
I would be pretty surprised if he plays, personally. I think they'd want to, they're starting off with the mighty Jacksonville Dolphins. I don't think they would want to rush a foot injury, let alone rush a foot injury so he could play against Jacksonville. So I would be pretty surprised if he plays, but, you never know. I mean, all things heal differently, but you tend to not want to be tricked, get cute with foot injuries, because those things can definitely linger.
Yeah, I tend to look for the Missouri game for his return. I don't think he'll play on Friday night either. Steele told us it would be a couple weeks at Media Day this past Monday. So, I think the Missouri game is a likely return date for him. And then we have Daniel Ramsey. He actually suffered a concussion in practice right before the exhibition, so he was held out of that. Have you heard anything about his potential availability for Jacksonville?
I have not. It's a concussion, obviously. It's kind of out of anyone's hands. It's all how his body reacts. But my guess is he probably wouldn't play. But, you know, you start talking concussions, it's just a whole different ballgame.
Right. We asked for some questions on social media. We got some pretty good ones. But the number one question that I've been hearing all offseason, or all since preseason practice started, is who's going to redshirt? Specifically, is Deontay Miles going to redshirt? I didn't think he played very well in the exhibition, but prior to that point, he's been pretty impressive during practice, and he's had his moments, whether it be in inter-squad scrimmages or maybe even the secret scrimmage. Brian, in your opinion, what do you expect them to do with Deontay Miles?
Gun to my head says he's not going to redshirt, but I honestly do not know. I think literally that decision will be made Tuesday morning. Could be wrong on that. Maybe they've already made the call, but I ultimately think they're just going to have him play, especially with Ramsey being in and out and, you know, Carter not full go. And you hate to make that decision based on what could be a situation for 2 weeks. But nonetheless, I just tend to think that he's going to play. But I could easily see him redshirting.
If they make the decision to play him this year, do you think that means Daniel Ramsey could be a redshirt candidate?
I think it's possible. I don't think they will. I think they're going to have Daniel play. But again, like if Daniel comes to them and says, I want a redshirt, I don't think they're going to say no. I just don't expect Daniel to say that.
This may be a stupid question, but if these guys dress out for the first game but don't play, can they make the decision later on, or does it have to be made before the first game tips off?
Technically, a redshirt decision isn't made until after the season. It's a matter of do you play or do you not play. So you can be, you know, in your uniform, you can warm up, it really doesn't matter. But once you step into a game to play, unless you get injured and or invent an injury, you cannot get your redshirt back.
But hypothetically, if they elected not to play Ramsey or Miles, if given them any on-court minutes, let's say in the first two games of the season, they could defer this decision a little bit later on to make the decision as, you know, maybe judging where Ramsey is with his return from concussion, whether Deontay continues to shine in practice, et cetera. I mean, hypothetically, they could do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we've seen teams in the past. Creighton did it with a big man a couple years ago.
With Epperson. Yeah. They took Epperson's red shirt off in like mid-January.
Right. We've seen teams do that when they get into some injury trouble. And, you know, that could be the case potentially with this team, especially because they're not super deep in terms of the front court. But I think they have good options. I don't think either of those two guys are going to be relied upon a ton. So it'll be interesting to see how that decision shakes out. I tend to lean towards what Brian said. I don't think Deontay redshirts, and I really haven't heard that conversation come up around Daniel's name at all, which makes me think he's probably not redshirting either. So this was a question we got on Twitter. Someone wanted to know, can this team shoot 30% or better this year from three-point range? I think that person would be surprised to find out the team shot 33.1% last year. So I do think they'll be able to shoot better than 30%. But Brian, do you think they'll be better than what they were last year, which was basically almost not even quite break even from 3-point range?
Yeah, probably I do. Just because I think, one, they'll take better threes. Two, I think the guys taking them are a little bit better shooting threes. Now, the line's further back, so I forget what the exact number is, but the last time the line moved back, it was like a 4% drop across college basketball in year one. Now, it goes back up immediately like the second year, but that first year is like a 4% drop or five. It was something like that. So in that case, it's tough to say, just, you know, you don't know. But ultimately, I would guess I would put the over under at 34.5 and just kind of go from there.
With snow dropping that, a little hashtag nugget. Dan, what do you say? You take the over under on 34.5 for this team.
I think it'll be a little bit lower than that. I think they'll shoot about the same percentage as they did last year. Although I hear what Snow's saying in terms of replacing some guys. I mean, for the most part, the main guys that are going to be on the court this year are the same guys. I think Paul Scruggs probably shot a little bit better percentage last year, particularly toward the end, than probably is his par. Although Najee was way worse and Quentin was way worse. So, but I think about 33-34% seems right to me. And I think that's good enough that it's not going to be a massive hindrance to this team. Now, obviously, they're not going to be Creighton who you know, shoots 40% and that's most of their offense. They're going to rely on transition. They're going to rely on getting the ball inside. They're going to rely on being tough with offensive rebounds, stick backs, et cetera. But I mean, 33-34% doesn't kill you. And I think they can at least be competitive there. The issue is going to be, I think the flip side of that, which is last year, there were just games where they just got absolutely annihilated from three and didn't really seem to have any clue about how to defend the perimeter. And maybe the answer to that is you can't really. But I think the delta between the number of points they give up from the three-point line, the number they score from the three-point line is something to watch, because last year there were games where it was just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, no question. I mean, they got killed on that in multiple games where they didn't even have a chance. It felt like you could pretty much look at the three-point field goals made and attempted in each game, and that told you the story for a lot of Xavier's games last season. Another question come in here. Will Kiki Tandy and Bryce Moore play together at all, or are there minutes coming at the same position? Brian, I mean, I think that's pretty clear cut. They're not really playing the same position at all, so they could definitely be on the court together.
Yeah. They theoretically, they could. I don't think they ever will, but theoretically, they could. At the end of the day, I think Xavier's going to want either Paul Scruggs or Quentin Gooden out there at all times. But yeah, Bryce Moore's playing straight two. Kiki's only learning the one, so absolutely they could be on the court together. That would give Xavier their most shooting. It would also give them far and away their worst decision-making lineup. So it would come with some good and some bad. But yeah, they could play together. I just don't think they will.
Yeah, I think it's more because of their role on this year's team being kind of the backups than it is that, you know, they're not compatible on the court in terms of their position.
Yeah.
Who averages more points per game, Zach Fremantle or Kiki Tandy?
I'll say Kiki Tandy.
Dan, what do you think?
I think Fremantle may be the number two big man. In fact, I don't think there's any question about that.
He clearly is.
And Tyreke Jones, as we've seen over the years, is not a guy who plays a particularly large percentage of the minutes, whether it be because he gets in foul trouble or whether it just be because he plays at such a high energy level. So I might go with Fremantle here. I think he's got enough that he'll scrape together maybe 7-8 points a game.
Ooh, that's a big number.
Is that too many? I don't know. 6-8 doesn't seem ridiculous to me. And I just don't know. I mean, do we think Kiki's going to get that many minutes?
I do.
Playing in the backcourt?
Oh, I definitely do.
I do. I think the minutes breakdown is, I think there's going to be kind of a set rotation of eight players. I think you're going to have your main five that we've talked about, Gooden, Scruggs, Marshall, Carter, and Jones. And then I think you've got Kiki as the backup at the one, Moore as your backup at the two or kind of the three, because those guards you can rotate really any way you want. And then you have Fremantle as your backup to either Carter or Jones as kind of your main rotation. And then aside from that, your kind of next guys in line will be Bishop for a few minutes occasionally, and, you know, your James and Miles and potentially Ramsey as well. But
so don't think that Bishop is potentially a rotation guy?
I mean, I think he'll definitely get minutes.
They really like him.
Yeah, I think he'll definitely get minutes, but I think ultimately, like, when you're in the heat of the Big East schedule and your rotation gets a little tighter, I think you kind of have your main eight guys, those first subs off the bench, and then Damir's kind of an extra sub, in my opinion. But we'll see. I mean, that certainly is the one that's most fluid, is Damir's playing time, in my opinion.
Yeah, and, you know, they really like him. He's made a lot of strides here in the last, I think, 2-3 weeks, really. This is, you know, a bunch of NBA guys came to practice, I forget when it was, and the guy that they liked the most on the roster was Damir Bishop. Now, obviously, he's not going to the NBA after this year, but, you know, in terms of down the road, that was kind of the guy that they were most like, hey, this kid's really got a chance because he's 6'5", he's long, he can shoot it. He's not a great shooter, but he can shoot it. You know, he's really doing a good job of getting to the rim right now. And in fact, he's been a better driver than he has a shooter, which is kind of a surprise to all of us that have seen him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, defensively, he's got the ability to be elite. Now, he's sure as heck not elite right now, not even anywhere close to it. But, you know, he's making strides quickly. So he's one, you know, it's going to be interesting because the staff really likes him. They really like what he can be. So we'll see what the future holds for Damir and the immediacy of the next, you know, month or so. If he plays well in the games where, quite honestly, they should be up by like 1,000, the mighty Jacksonville Dolphins, Siena, schools like that, he can earn himself some, you know, some trust going into the Big East season or the tougher part of the non-conference season.
Yeah, I think that's right. I knew he was a good athlete from seeing him in AAU, but it almost feels like he's kind of had that Edmund Sumner thing happen where he gets on campus, adds some muscles, and all of a sudden he's more explosive than we realized. And Quentin Gooden talked about that too when we did the podcast on Media Day, that Damir's explosiveness surprised him, and then also that I was surprised how much Quentin gave Damir props for his defense. So that was interesting to hear as well.
I actually also was he to me was the most eye-opening thing about the exhibition game. Obviously, I mean, Najee played really well in the second half. Quentin played really well in the second half, but Damir had some really nice moments in the second half. And that Edmund Sumner comparison was one that, I mean, it's obvious when you look at the guy, when you look at, you know, his size and sort of his physique at this point. But there was one play where I think he got an and one where he drove around his man from like the right point or something like that. And it was that you had that Edmund Sumner first step where he took one dribble and you're like, whoa, how did he go that far?
Yeah.
So that was definitely that comparison rings true to me, although obviously they're different players, but there's some superficial things that are very similar about the two of them.
Yeah, and I think fans saw the confidence that Damir had. You know, every time he got that ball and he was remotely open, that thing's going up. And I would tell you, Kiki's very similar in that way. When he gets in, he doesn't even need an open look. He's shooting the ball pretty much every time he touches it, it feels like. So both of those guys.
I was about to say, Damir
confident.
Needs to be open. Kiki just needs the ball.
that's about right, yeah. If Najee Marshall and Paul Scruggs are first and second on the team again in scoring, who is third this year?
Tyreek Jones.
I think that's
right. I'd agree with that. I mean, Tyreek, again, playing a Division II team, so it's tough to gauge. But he showed a little bit more finesse in his when he was catching the ball with his back to the basket. Had a couple nice finishes with little baby hooks, stuff that you didn't see him do a whole lot last year. So maybe he's ready to make a leap forward. Now, that being said, he also got two stupid fouls within about 8 seconds of one another and found himself on the bench for 10 minutes, which is another unfortunate hallmark of Tyreek's style over the years. But yeah, I mean, he's also the emotional leader of the team. He's a guy that pumps up his teammates. His teammates love throwing him the ball. They love watching him finish. They love watching him go crazy. So I think it'll definitely be Tyreek as number three. And I think that bodes well for Xavier because this is going to sound like almost an insult, but it's not meant to be. I think the less scoring load you put on Quentin Gooden, the better he's going to be. And I think if Tyreek can establish himself as that third option, that sets Quentin up really nicely to have a good year as a facilitator rather than being relied upon to create.
Brian, do you think there's any chance Jason Carter is in the mix for that spot?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Carter, it's been interesting because, in you know, he hasn't played this. He didn't play the scrimmage. He didn't play the exhibition. And in Spain, they really limited how they used Carter. They didn't put him on the post at all. They didn't really do a lot with him. And they've put that stuff in. I mean, I don't think it's any world secret that, you know, they're going to use him a variety of different ways. And that means getting him to score as well. So it'll be interesting to see how much he scores. They're going to play through him a lot. He's kind of their second playthrough guy. You got Quentin, who's a playthrough guy. And then I would say Jason Carter is their second decision maker who's going to be on the court. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how that role develops as the year goes along.
Yeah, I think the guys love playing with Jason, but they also love playing with Jason because he's really unselfish and he's a good passer and he's versatile and can do a lot of things and he'll do the dirty work. I'm a little bit concerned for Jason's sake how aggressive he's going to be on the offensive end and looking for his own shot, because with this group of guys and even the young guys that are coming off the bench, no one around him is afraid to shoot it. So I'm interested to see if he's willing to take charge enough. On Ohio, he had no choice. The ball was always going to come to him, and they were always going to have to play through him, and he was going to be asked to score. On this team, he won't necessarily be asked to. So will he be willing to sort of step up and show that he can do that? I think he will, but that's kind of one of the things I'm watching with him.
Yeah, I tend to think he's not going to be overly bashful.
Okay. Who will lead this team in blocks, do you think?
Tyreek. Mostly because, I mean, like, Fremantle will block a few shots, Carter will block a few shots, Najee will block a few shots, but you figure Tyreek's going to be playing 25 to 30 minutes and he's going to be in a position to block the most shots, so I'll go with Tyreek Jones. Now, he's not going to block as many shots as, you know, Hankins did, but I think he'll block a few here and there.
Yeah, assuming Deontay Miles does not redshirt, he will have the highest block rate on the team. I think Fremantle could be second in terms of rate because Tyreek just doesn't block a lot of shots, but he will probably have the most in terms of accounting number.
Tend to agree.
All right, and then one more question here about the team, and this is kind of a little bit more for the postseason, but it was asked multiple times, so we'll go ahead and address it. Brian, you've been pretty good about this in the past, so do you think fans should enter the season with the mindset that this is the last year they'll see Najee Marshall and Paul Scruggs in a Xavier uniform?
Whew. I'll say one of the two leaves, one of the two comes back, and don't ask me which one because I have no idea.
It's really going to depend on how their year goes, right?
Yeah. Depend on the year, depend on their role, depend on how they're feeling. For instance, let's say Scruggs has a really good year, but he's told, you know, you're still a second-round pick, and Travis is like, well, you're going to be the full-time point guard next year. That might get Paul to come back. You know, Najee's told he's not going to be drafted. Does Najee go, all right, I'll come back? You know, I just don't know.
Let's say Paul shoots 33% or 34% from three this year after shooting 37% last year. You're going to have a lot of ammo as the coaches to say, I mean, you can clearly shoot better than that if you come back.
Yeah. So I would guess both don't return. But I genuinely don't know which one I think is more likely to come back. If, believe it or not, if I had to guess, I'd probably say Najee comes back, Paul leaves, and people are going to question that. But just knowing those kids a little bit, and I'll kind of leave that alone. But I would guess Najee is more likely to come back than Paul is, but neither's a lock to come back and neither's a lock to leave.
That's pretty much how I feel about it, too. And I always like when Snow gives a little cryptic, like, I know more than you guys, but I can't really tell you what I mean by it. So that's always good. You know he knows
more than he does that. Well, I didn't really need to. I just kind of got caught in the moment.
No, that's a classic Snow move. I like that.
We always get, like, when Snow writes his book, and which will sell, like, 8 copies. But, you know.
It'll sell exactly how many people we have subscribed to the message board at that point, because he's been...
You're underestimating peaks.
Well, true. Every message board that he's been promoting it on for years will buy a copy. I can assure you of that. So.
Exactly.
All right. Let's go to the Big East Conference as a whole. Xavier was picked third in the coaches' poll behind Seton Hall and Villanova. Dan, we'll start with you. What did you think of that top three? Do you agree going in, or I mean, do you think Villanova should always be number one like I do? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where until somebody knocks them off that perch, I guess Xavier did for 1 year, but they won the national title, so it's hard to really.
So you're saying Villanova had the better year?
Yeah.
What a ridiculous thought is that?
Just by a hair. So I think until somebody knocks them off their perch, I don't know how you can bet against them, especially when you consider, you know, that they lose a lot from last year, but the recruiting class that Jay brought in is pretty spectacular. They're going to have some guy. Now, it is a little bit going to be interesting, relying on a five-star kid, but which I don't think they've done a whole lot of over this past run of Nova dominance. And then with Seton Hall, you just got a veteran team with one of the two real killers in this conference that can take over a game at any time in Miles Powell. So yeah, I mean, I can't really argue with that. I guess my biggest thing is that as I look down from where Xavier is it's like I can make a case for a lot of those teams as top three teams if a few things go their way. And I think this league is going to be once again as tight and bunched as you could probably find around college basketball. And that could, again, inure to the league's detriment because people look at it and say, oh, there's just like seven mediocre teams in this league. Or it could be that people look at it and say, holy crap, there's not a night off in this conference. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I don't know. But third seems right. But I think we all agree that this Xavier team, if certain things go right, is talented enough hypothetically, that if they get some breaks along the way, could win this conference and could probably finish sixth or seventh if things don't go their way. So there's a wide variance in the possible outcomes this year.
Well, yeah, and I think the problem with that is, you know, first and second, maybe there's a little separation, but then probably, you know, third through seventh, they're all going to be about the same once again in terms of their conference record. Snow, what do you think about the top three?
It made sense. And here's the thing is, like, to me, if you were to poll the coaches, who's got the best starting five, they'd probably take Xavier's. Now, there's a little bit of question beyond those five, obviously. But in terms of the starting five, Xavier's probably got the most talented veteran starting five in the league. Now, they don't have the best player like a Miles Powell or a Marcus Howard. But just in terms of one to five, it's probably Xavier. So in that respect, like, hey, could Xavier win the league? Sure. Could they finish seventh? Hell yeah. I mean, they were 9-9 last year, and you know, they got a lot of the same personnel back. So, but what I think you're going to see about the league is, Dan kind of brought this up, it's going to be bunched, but I think it's going to be bunched in the way that the Big 12 has been bunched for the past few years, where it's like everyone looks and it's just like, man, there's no day off. Now, part of that's going to come with how you do in the non-conference, but you know, even St. John's, like, they've got LJ Figueroa and Mustafa Haron. Like, two of the top 10 players in the league are on the team everyone would pick 10th. DePaul might have the best pro in the league in Paul Reed. Like, they're 9th. Butler has Kamar Baldwin. They're 8th. So you look at it, it's like, any given night, you could be in trouble. Especially, you know, St. John's, they got a new coach. And say what you want about Mike Anderson. We know this for 100% fact. He's a better coach than Chris Mullin. And so is beating St. John's. Now, they're still going to play crazy because that's how Mike plays, but it's organized craziness as opposed to Mullin, which was just roll the ball out and let everybody go YOLO. So, you know, I don't think St. John's is going to be easy to beat. You know, DePaul's got talent up and down the roster. Now they're dysfunctional, but they're talent. Then Butler, that's winning in Hinkle's not easy. And then the school I think people are underestimating is Georgetown. I think they're a load this year.
Me too. I think they could very easily be up in that top three. You know, when Dan was talking about some of the other teams, when you look down there, I think they're one, and even Creighton is another one that I think could be better than some people are thinking. Am I crazy to think that Seton Hall was a little overrated? I mean, I understand they have the best player in the conference probably, but nothing after him really impresses me about Seton Hall. Like, Miles Kale and Quincy McKnight do very little for me.
I think they're just good enough.
I mean, they're role players. That's the nice thing, is they have guys who know their roles, which is big. But I just don't know. As the best team in the conference, I don't know.
It's interesting. I think half of basketball is your best player knowing he's your best player, and then everyone else on the roster knowing who your best player is. And I think they have that. That was Marquette's problem last year. The best player knew he was the best player, but the number two and number three player thought that he wasn't the best player.
Well, and I was going to ask you that about Marquette. Is there a chance they're better because everyone understands what the deal is and they know how they're going to play and people will be okay with that?
Oh, I think with that, I'm not going to say without a doubt they're better, but without a doubt there's a chance that they're better just simply because of that. Also, they have a little bit more ball handling this year with Kobe McEwen. The transfer from Utah State, I think he's a big help to things. Last year, they had really one guy who did all the dribbling. This year, you know, Marcus Howard can play off the ball, and Kobe McEwen can take some pressure and some heat off of him. So I think that helps a lot as well. You know, Theo John, they got a little bit more depth down low. It comes down with Marquette, to me, it comes down to, can Jamal Cain make plays? Can he make threes from the four spot?
I mean, is Sakaar Anum their second best player? That's my issue. Is that who their second best player is? Because I think it is.
I think it's Kobe McEwen.
Okay. I mean, if that's the case, that'll help for sure.
Yeah.
Because they need another guy.
Yeah. Kobe McEwen's he's not a dude, but he's dude-like.
Okay. Put that in the snow a dictionary, please.
You know, you're either a guy, you're a dude. He's not quite a dude, but, you know, he's got dude tendencies. So I think they've got a little bit more ball handling this year. That helps. And I think people will be on the same page more. And they might actually give effort, unlike the Housers did in February and March.
All right. Snow, what do you think? I mean, you're pretty close to the Butler program. Are they going to be terrible again?
They think they're going to be really good. I'm a little less bullish than they are. But Bryce Enzi, the transfer from Milwaukee, is really interesting to me. He's got a little bit of that Travis game to him. How exactly good he is will determine a lot, because I think he's got to be their second best player. And he's going to play. He's going to give them more of a physical four. They've had to play McDermott at the four, and McDermott's just, he wears down because he's 152 pounds. So that's kind of been a problem for them. Now with Enzi, they don't have to do that. So I think it'll be interesting to see, but I would pick Butler seventh or eighth or whatever it is.
Yeah, it feels about right. Any other takes or thoughts on the Big East Conference as a whole that you guys have you want to get out there?
Can you guys kind of walk through what exactly this flopping rule that they're bringing in is? Because I've read a little bit about it, but I haven't really digested it much.
Do you think refs are going to call flops?
No.
Okay. Then there's nothing to talk
except
about.
Except that doofus during the NCAA tournament, I can't remember what team he was on, that did the pro wrestling style sell and got teed up. This is going to drive me nuts. But you guys know the play I'm talking about, right?
Wasn't that in a conference tournament? Wasn't it like Lipscomb or something?
Yeah, that might have been it.
Nailed it.
Yeah, it was like Lipscomb. He like dove back 13 feet like he got hit by a sledgehammer. His feet came off the ground.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I think that was a conference tournament. It was either Lipscomb or Belmont or one of those schools.
I guess I just don't understand how something like that is workable without having endless and awful video reviews, which is the last thing we need more of.
Is it a video review thing? I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it to really explain it because I don't care about it. It's not going to happen.
They're not going to call it, so yeah. It's irrelevant.
Right.
It's the classic point of emphasis that maybe you see four times in the first two games and everyone gets mad about, and then you don't see it again the rest of the year and everyone forgot it was actually a point of emphasis. So
Wisconsin fans will be big mad if they start calling flops.
One thing that I have noticed so far this year, just in the limited bits of action that I've seen is we got a geographic problem because people don't know where they can catch the ball in the corner anymore. And we're going to see a couple turnovers a game with dudes just randomly stepping out of bounds, right?
Yeah, we had that at least once in the Xavier exhibition.
And it happened 19 times in Europe. or they went to Europe, Spain, whatever.
Yeah, I think that's because there were 16 different lines painted on those rec gym courts they were playing in, though.
Yeah, that's going to be a thing. I mean, you see it happen in the NBA, too, quite honestly. So it's going to be a thing.
I do have a question for you guys because I haven't had a chance to go to practice this summer, and I can't really speak from experience. But obviously, it's year two with Travis at the helm. Do you guys see anything differently out of the way he's coaching the team or running the program this year than maybe the first time around? Like, are there lessons that he's learned that you see, or is he just basically the same dude as he was last season?
You know, I don't think he's changed much, but I do think people have changed with the way they react to him. Like, I think the guys are used to him now, and they understand, like, he's the head coach. He's the disciplinarian. He's not messing around, you know, when he yells at him or whatever. I just think the tone's a little bit different from everyone, that they just understand he's kind of the guy.
Yeah, that's what I would say the biggest. I don't think he's changed his tone at all. It's the fact that everyone's now on the same page on who the head coach is.
Yeah, I would say, like, that's one of the things I was really impressed with him last year. I didn't think he ever really looked like he was, you know, shook up by any of it, or he didn't have his voice. Like, he was the same guy throughout. He always held the guys accountable, regardless of what fans want to think, you know, based on the turnovers that continued to happen or the poor defense that continued to happen. Like, he was not letting guys get away with anything in practice. He was really tough on them. You know, like, I don't think he has had to adjust at all, really, in terms of who he is with the guys. I think they've kind of adjusted to him better, though.
Yeah, I know the fans, like, the whole holding accountable thing. Like, my man, like, everyone knows if you're Paul Scruggs and you turn the ball over, he's not putting Keyonte Kennedy in.
Right.
Like, he's just not going to. Like, Paul Scruggs turning it over is better than Keyonte Kennedy not turning it over. It's just a reality. So those guys, it wasn't a lack of accountability in terms of the coach. It was a lack of accountability in terms of who was behind them in the rotation.
Yeah, the personnel made that difficult, certainly, in terms of playing time. Yeah. But all right, it is everybody's favorite time of the podcast. It is time to go down Xavier's schedule and play the win-loss game. We will start with the Tuesday night game against Jacksonville to start the season at 7 p.m. I think that's a win. And then on Friday at 7 p.m., they'll face Siena. And then next Tuesday, November 12th, they will host Missouri. What are you guys' thoughts on the Missouri game at home?
I have very little respect for Missouri this year, I'll be honest with you.
But they did kick Xavier's ass last year.
Yeah, I would argue Xavier kicked Xavier's ass last year.
That's probably fair.
But I just don't think they're a very good team. And, Xavier might play poorly for a stretch because they'll beat Siena by 1,000 and feel like they're actually good and feel like they don't need to show up and play. But they're going to – I would be surprised if they don't beat Missouri. I just – you know, Missouri's just not very good. They're just not.
I think after last year's debacle, X will be ready for this game, and it'll be their first real test of the season. It's their first real opportunity to show that last season wasn't what this program is, and I think they'll win that.
I think
– For the record, I think Missouri State might be the better team than Missouri.
Well, okay. I don't think that's true. And also, I think Missouri's style of play, they're going to slow it down, make it ugly, defend. I think they'll pack it in, and they could make it tough on Xavier in terms of scoring like they did last year. So this game, I think, is a reason to be concerned if you're a Xavier fan, and it could be a close call. I do think Xavier pulls it out, though. They'll face Missouri State on that Friday night, November the 15th. Snow, since you think Missouri State is so good, do you have any concerns about that one?
Yes, because the players aren't going to respect Missouri State. And since they're not going to respect Missouri State, the thing about it is Missouri State has a bunch of transfers coming in. They're really good. They're pretty much everyone thinks they're the best team in the Valley. And when you see Missouri State and you're a player, you don't get too fired up. It would not surprise me if Missouri State makes that one really interesting.
The Jared Ritter game.
Yeah, Ritter returns.
The storyline.
Is he about to play?
Storyline cannot be underrated.
I mean, he's going to hit 6 threes if he's eligible. They may put a mustache on him and run him out there as somebody else.
Honestly, is he still there?
I have no idea.
I haven't read up on Missouri State's roster enough, if I'm being honest.
I'm gonna Google this. You guys just, you know, talk some crap.
Dan, you're taking that as a win, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, which means the team will head to Charleston for the Charleston Classic. Starting on that Thursday, they'll face
Tyson. Yeah, he's still there.
Ritter time.
Okay, so you underline that storyline. Ritter returns to Xavier on November 15th.
Snow thinks it's a monster. He averaged 5.1. He had 5.1 points a game.
Oh, okay.
Last year.
Did he play? Oh, he played last year. I didn't even know that. So there you go.
He played 23 games with a pair of starts. It looks like he became eligible at the semester break. So,
Dan.
Yeah.
Dan, what do you have?
I now know more about Jared Ritter's career than either of you. So that's
congrats.
It's a sad state of affairs. Yeah.
How do you have this team doing at the Charleston Classic? They face Towson in the first round Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m.
Well, I will be there for the first two games, so I'm looking quite forward to that. I think they should beat Towson, and I think they should beat UConn in the second game as well. Now, what they do on Sunday, I have no idea. I'm leaving Saturday, so I don't really care that much. But certainly, if they can get a matchup with Florida, that would be a really nice opportunity to, even with a loss, to boost the strength schedule.
So what are you saying, 2-1 there?
Yeah, I think so, 2-1.
Okay.
I'm like Dan, I have them beating the mighty Towson. I don't – what is Towson?
The Tigers.
Anyone know their mascot?
Right, Tigers?
I'll go with it. I think they'll get UConn and they'll beat UConn. I think UConn's going to be improved this year, but I don't think they're – I think Xavier's just a bit more talented. Then I would have them facing Florida and taking an L to the Crocodiles in an exciting and thrilling Sunday evening game.
Hold on. What? The Crocodiles?
That's what I call them. 1 year on their media guide, they put a crocodile on there instead of an alligator.
Okay.
So I've called them the Crocodiles.
All right. That's enough out of you. I've got them 2-1 with the loss to Florida as well. They come back. They play Lipscomb at home on November 30th, Saturday at noon. I think we can all mark that down as a W. They also play Green Bay on Wednesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. And that leads us up to the Saturday, December 7th, 5 p.m. Crosstown Shootout at the Cintas Center. What say you guys about this year's Crosstown Shootout?
Well, first of all, we all know who Rick's picking to win the game. You know, with John Wooden on the sidelines in Clifton now, we all know Rick's going with the Bearcats.
I'll be there in my Bearcat jersey.
Ooh, jersey. I like that move.
Well, I'm classy. I wouldn't let my pits hang out in a jersey.
I think Xavier's a really bad matchup for UC because I don't think UC's going to rebound really well. I just look at a front court with Jay Sorolla and Chris Vogt and Mamadou Diarra, and I'm like, I just don't see it. To me, Najee Marshall's the perfect matchup for Jaron Cumberland. That's not to say he's going to stop Jaron Cumberland. He's not going to do that. But he's the type of guy that really gives Jaron problems. So I think Xavier matches up pretty well with UC. I'm just not on the Javon Cumberland train. Sorry, everybody. I think UC will be solid this year. I think Xavier's better. Although I do the communists at Fox, I want to hurt them because they scheduled this game at 5 o'clock. Screwing up my daily Big Ten championship game, Crosstown Shootout doubleheader that I had a few years ago. So people at FS1, you're dead to me.
Wow. Strong statements. I think this game is going to be a mirror image of the 2017 shootout. But you're going to have Jaron Cumberland playing the role of Trayvon Blewett, going off for an incredible game, having Xavier fans stunned at the Cintas Center at halftime with the Musketeers trailing. And then in the second half, Xavier's just going to kick their ass on the glass and end up pulling the game out with toughness. Dan, what do you think?
I mean, I don't really – UC's turned over so much of their roster and has a new coach, and we have not a huge amount of idea about how they're going to look. So
you don't know a lot about their big man from Valparaiso.
We make predictions.
Well, I'm not going to pick UC to win at CentOS.
You didn't watch enough Oakland basketball last year, Dan?
I watched plenty of Oakland basketball, as you know. Who's their dude? Hill Mays. Yeah, that dude was ridiculous.
Yeah, he doesn't suck.
I don't know what happened to him. Is he still there?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Player of the year this year.
Yeah. Well, you'll get to see him a few times, I guess. Xavier should win, I think. I hope. I don't want to think about the possibility of them not winning, so I'm going to pick them to win.
Okay. And following up on the shootout, they have a week break, and they will play the Skip Prosser Classic at Wake Forest this year. That's on a Saturday, December 14th at 4 p.m. Are either of you concerned about the Wake Forest game? Wake Forest is not very good this year.
No.
I kind of am, because it seems like the kind of stupid game that Xavier loses in December every year. So if they were going to take
really hard to lose to Wake Forest.
Dan,
I think they win this and they beat Western Carolina. And then I think that TCU game is probably the second non-conference loss, maybe the third, if you assume that Missouri and Wake are sort of Missouri and UC are sort of coin flips.
I have the same exact non-conference record as Dan. I have them beating or losing to Florida and Charleston and at TCU. Snow, are you adding on another loss here?
No, that's exactly how I have it as well.
All right, so we're all at 11-2.
I'm going to say 10-3. I think they drop another game along the lines. I'm just not sure which one. I guess probably Missouri, if I had to guess. Okay. But yeah, I think 10-3 is probably where I would be.
You know what I love about Dan is every time we do this segment, he always gets through it and then disagrees with what he said previously. Every single time.
Dan contradicting his own takes.
Yeah.
Every single time, unlike any other.
All right, we will go and break down the Big East game by game before we get to the Big East schedule, but we always give a little prediction just from an overview perspective. What do you think they do in the Big East and finish the year at?
I have 11-7, which I think would put them 3-4-5 range.
Yeah, so 22-9 on the year?
Yeah, 22-9. Tend to think that that 13 wins might get it done in the conference to win the conference this year, because I don't see a dominant team and I see a lot of losses for everybody. So I could see like 13-5 being first place, 11-7, you know, there'll be like three teams at that level, a couple 9-9s. I don't think you're going to see anyone like 2-16 in the league or anything like that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I can see St. John's winning 5-6 games. So I don't think anything's – I think 11-7, and they're going to be not playing on Wednesday in Madison Square Garden.
Dan?
Yeah, I'd say 11-7 seems right to me. That's what Ken Pom's got him at, which who am I to contradict him? So 11-7 under my 10-3 non-conference would be what, 21-10 for the regular season, which is, you know, in the Big East Conference a pretty good record, and ought to have them very comfortably into wearing white jerseys in the first round of the tournament if they were to get to that point. So, I think 21-10 with some upside.
Yeah. I've got the same overall record as you, Dan, at 21-10, but I'm going 11-2 in non-conference, and I'm going 10-8 in the Big East. I just think, you know, a game over 500 in the Big East this year is going to be doing really, really well, because I think it is going to be a bear of a conference. So I think that could be good enough to be third in this conference. So I think that's how it plays out. Any other thoughts here before we sign off and end this podcast?
Dan, you're a deep thinker. Go ahead.
Nothing about the Bengals, though, Dan. I know how you are.
Oh, I do want to ask, what do we think about the kill statistic and barking, the encouragement to bark like a dog?
Yeah, I don't know if that's the most well thought out thing.
Well, first of all, this is one of those things that will get at some point thrown back in their face in a really humiliating and probably funny way.
At Butler?
at every single team they play on the road this year, probably, that has a fan base worthy of the name. But I, The kill concept, I do like. I'm a little bit, I would like to see the numbers, I guess, on where they got this whole like 98% if they get 7 kills in a game. Because it sounds made up, but I'm not saying it's made up. I'm just saying it sounds made up on first blush. But yeah, it's kind of something to watch. It feels like kind of a nonsense statistic, like a save or something like that. But there is some logic behind it by the same token, because getting consecutive stops can facilitate, you know, a run. So
yeah, I think it's more of a stayed locked in thing too. When you have sustained effort on defense like that, you know, you have a reason to stay locked in like that. Coming up with something, I think, is a good idea to kind of trick the guys to keep themselves locked.
Yeah, it's a cool way to kind of put little. It's the same concept as like Chris is the first coach that I remember. I'm sure there were people that did it otherwise that really focused on the 4-minute war as something that was sort of a bite-sized thing that guys could lock in on in a short period of time. So you're not thinking about the entire game as a whole, but you're just thinking about the bit that's right in front of you. And this is kind of the same deal, right? It's like a Joey Votto who kind of just takes at bat by at bat, pitch by pitch, and tries to be super analytical about each stage in the process. So I see the point to it. I'm a little surprised that they're making as big a deal as they are with like the crowd as a whole.
I like the crowd participation idea. I just don't know that you're going to convince a bunch of rich old white people to bark in the lower bowl. That's my number one problem with it. I don't think it's going to catch on very well.
I just want to see it.
I think the student section will probably bark.
Yeah.
And that will probably be good enough. I don't know that you're going to get a lot of barking from other portions of. But you know what? Prove me wrong. If it's like.
I want Bob Kohlhepp barking.
He's probably one of the few down there that would do it because he's into the games. I don't imagine that you're going to see like elderly matrons shaking their pearls, and they probably would yip like a shih tzu or something like that, which might be funny in and of itself.
That would be pretty good if we got a bunch of chihuahuas out there too.
Right, exactly. I mean, they didn't specify what kind of dog.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see how this develops, but I like that they're making a thing out of it, because I think it's something that if you were keyed into the program and if you're following, you listen to the post game shows or to the coaches show, you heard references to this over and over the years. Right. But kind of bringing the crowd into it is a idea that could work or could be stupid, but we're going to see.
Yeah. I think it's always good that they're trying to be innovative and find things like this and, you know, try to keep pushing things to the next level. I don't know that this one's going to work. I'm also a little bit surprised in today's PC culture that they're willing to go ahead and put kill out there as like a thing they're going for. Seems a bit risky,
private
in my
school,
opinion.
Rick. Private school.
Good point.
Yeah, I actually didn't even think about that.
But now you think it's a good point.
I mean
pretty woke. Third eye woke.
I don't know, man. I listen to your takes on Skinner's podcast, and sometimes I wonder if you're the same guy that I know.
I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
I don't know. It's just that isn't true. You have the integrity of your convictions on that show. It's Skinner.
My brand stays pretty true.
It's true. It's true. Your discussion of the Bengals last week was particularly good, I thought.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Snow, do you have any final thoughts to wrap this up?
First of all, Dan, to address the kill thing, to me it's not like a save. A save is simply like what time you get three outs in a game, and it's just convoluted in terms of how it's put together. But just from a practicality standpoint, 7 kills, that's 21 stops.
Right.
If you're defending for 68 possessions, you know, there's a lot of function to that.
And you're sequencing them, which means that you're building momentum during those periods. I get it.
I've questioned the 98% thing quite a bit. I asked someone within the program, and he said they ran the numbers. It's actually pretty close. I think it's closer to like 94%, but I guess 98 sounds better.
We're going to be shot now. We're probably on a list for letting that out. Mario put us on his hit list,
I swear I didn't even ask Mario.
I know you didn't. But we're wait,
you think Mario's going to do that sort of research project?
Hell no, he's not.
Exactly. No one's listening to this anyway.
Dan, did you just whisper, or was that like CIA that just got on the call?
No, it was a ghost. Okay, it was Mario. It was Mario. He infiltrates the calls to make sure we're
Snow, do you have someone staying over again tonight?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. That was a good podcast, too. Remember when I left that in? Dan's bathroom break and Snow getting interrupted by someone staying in his house randomly. I did that
good,
with the
good editing by you.
Yeah, I did that with the skinny podcast this week. I uploaded the wrong version. That wasn't good.
So. Well, the problem with doing that is that if you're like me and you have your like a podcast app that refreshes every once in a while, you can catch that first version sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Some people did.
Yeah.
You were made aware that people caught the first version?
Was there something funny on the first version? Like, was Skinner just like making body noises or something?
No, it was just that we had started the podcast with the basketball preview first, and that was actually the last half of the podcast. So we just intro with an interview with Brendel with the basketball, and also the first time we tried the interview, like 20 seconds in, Skinny yanked his mic, which pulled the cord on the mic we're recording the conversation with too on the phone for Brendel. So it just slams into the phone and cuts the phone off and hangs up on Brendel. So that was excellent. It was really good radio for the first people listening to it for the first 20 seconds were like, what the hell just happened?
Good work by Skinny.
Yeah. Old man Skinny doing his thing. All right. Well, I think that does it for this edition of the Dane and Victory podcast. For the legend, Brian Snow, and Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.